Welcome, and today is the 14th of October, 2008. Humans are riddled with desire. And they're rushing here and rushing there, trying to fulfill desire. So that's rajas, mode of passion or mode of desire. And no matter how many desires you fulfill, more and more will come. Like rivers into the ocean. They are unending. That's the category that the vast majority of people fit into. People in the mode of ignorance are either lazy, lethargic, unmotivated, depressed, unhappy, or they're destructive, the criminally minded, insane, crazy, out of control. That's all mode of ignorance. Addicted, so therefore not in the right mind. Generally don't accomplish much, and what they do accomplish is does more harm than good. That's all mode of ignorance. So you got a smaller minority of people in that mode. And then you got a small minority of people in the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness is conducive to happiness, peace, joy, for the sake of joy, knowledge, understanding, study, learning, understanding the difference between spirit and matter. Education, teaching yoga is the mode of goodness. It doesn't mean that the people that are sitting in front of you are all in the mode of goodness, but the practice of yoga, the performance of yoga, is the mode of goodness. And if those people continue to practice yoga, they will be raised up to the mode of goodness. As long as it's being sort of taught in a traditional manner. This aerobics yoga and, sweat yoga and power yoga and all this stuff, that's not yoga. That's not yoga. That's aerobic yoga or whatever that other stuff is. Yoga is always in the mode of goodness. So it's always done very calmly and peacefully. There's none of this stuff going on in yoga. The yin and the yang in the yoga is the breathing within the asana. When you assume the asana and you breathe in, you breathe out. Within the asana, that's how it's done. So a lot of people think yoga is for losing weight and fitness, which of course it isn't for that at all. But that's fine, because it can do that. And if that's what brings people to yoga, great. But that's not its purpose. Its purpose is to condition the body so you can sit like this for hours on end and it won't bother you. So you can meditate. That's the purpose of the asanas. Patanjali would not disagree, I don't think. See, if these ones that are doing like the ex-aerobicized yoga, that's mode of passion. That's definitely mode of passion. That's not mode of goodness. And yoga is, by nature, its mode of goodness. Today is a very, very auspicious day. Today is the full moon, the Purnima, and it is the full moon of the Sharat season, which is, in India, the most auspicious time of the entire year. Today. Because on this day is celebrated Diwali, the festival of the lights. and that is connected, I think, primarily to Lakshmiji, isn't it? Because today is Lakshmi Puja, or the worship of Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. And so Kalindi has presented the Festival of Lights in a small way here for us. And we are going to do an RT ceremony a little bit later to the devas present there on the altar, Lakshmi, Vishnu, Radha Krishna, and Ganesh is there as well. And we'll do that a little bit later. In RT, what you essentially do is you make an offering to God or to the goddess. And the offering should encompass the five elements. What are the five elements of creation? Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Bhumarappannalovayu kammano buddhirevacha. So the five elements. So that's how an art, that is what an RT is based on, those elements. And so different things are offered with that in mind. I'll point that out to you as we do it. The air is the fan and the whisk. Right. This is also a very auspicious day because it is the Rasa Leela of Sri Krishna. Krishna, who is God, or an incarnation of God, of Vishnu. Some think that Vishnu is an incarnation of Krishna. I won't argue that point right now. It's one and the same. When Krishna was here 5,000 years ago in India, he did many, many wonderful activities and pastimes that were superhuman. And I don't mean by making a little dust fall from his fingers like certain gurus are doing these days. But he did amazing things, like he lifted a hill with his little finger of his left hand. When he was even a child, a toddler, he was attacked by very powerful demons that were sent to kill him off.
Like
yeah, wait, exactly.
A blue version.
Yeah. And that's where they got the blue suit from. And Krishna's was prophesied to be the eighth child of Devaki and Vasudev, his parents, who would kill off Kamsa, the wicked uncle who had usurped the throne of his father. And so he was prophesied that he would be the death of Kamsa. So Kamsa sent all kinds of demons who could shapeshift and take all kinds of terrible forms, and to kill him off even when he was a child. They even sent a witch, Putana. Of course, we know what Puta is in Italian or in Spanish. Well, her name was Putana. And she shape-shifted herself into a very, very beautiful woman. And apparently, in those days, maybe it's still common in India, I don't know. In those days, when you had a new baby, if a woman, because all women will come to see your new baby naturally, but if you have breast milk, you say, well, I want to breastfeed your child. And this was very common. You can come and breastfeed. Oh, yes, please. Breastfeed my child. And off we go, you know. So they gave the boy to this, who they thought was a lovely lady, you know, gorgeous lady, to breastfeed the child. And she took the child outside into the courtyard. And you know, she transformed herself into this hag, which she was by nature. Yeah, and she had put poison on her nipple to kill the baby. And because Krishna was God, he sucked the life force out of her. And she died. And the poison didn't affect him. That's one story. So he did many wonderful, inexplicable, superhuman pastimes. He also danced the Rasa Leela. You've heard of the gopis. The gopis were the cowherd maidens of Vrindavan. They were an agrarian, rural, farmer society. It's called Vaishya in Sanskrit. And that wasn't his real family. His real family was actually a Kshatriya family, princes, kings. But he was taken so he wouldn't be killed by that wicked uncle right after his birth and switched with another child. So he was raised by foster parents, Nanda and Yashoda, in this agrarian community. And then there were many young girls his age, a little bit older. And they were all enamored by him. Everybody was enamored by Krishna. Because Krishna is the most beautiful person ever. And no one could ever stop thinking about him. No one could take their eyes off of him. And he played the flute. And when you'd hear the sound, it would describe what would happen when he'd play to everybody, including the plants and the blades of grass and the cows and the calves, and everybody becomes stunned, the deer, forest animals, the grown-ups, the adults, the children, everybody was absolutely overwhelmed by the beauty of this sound, Krishna's flute, and his ankle bells around his ankles as he ran. So that's all anybody could think about, because everybody was God conscious. In the spiritual world, there's no talking. There's only singing. In the spiritual world, there's no walking. There's only dance. That's the spiritual world. Why do you think people like these musicals so much? You know, Gilbert and Sullivan or Broadway musicals or, you know, whatever. Everybody knows they're nonsense. Bollywood musicals. In other words, it's not real life. Who breaks into song, you know, at the drop of a hat, and then, you know, everybody in the market joins in and there's a whole dance number and they're throwing oranges around. Who does this? In the spiritual world, that's how things are. And when we watch this, we love it, don't we? We love it.
We just don't admit it.
We don't admit it.
I told Mama me at 5:10.
Yeah. She admits it.
I'm going again.
There you go. So that's where it comes from. So Krishna's beauty is captivating. Krishna means beautiful, captivating, the most beautiful.
So he's like a movie star, right?
Yeah.
He's got that.
Yeah. And Krishna is also, he's got the X factor. And Krishna's androgynous. He's masculine. But he's also, he's masculine, but his feminine side is also very strongly developed. And the style at that time, long hair, and they wear earrings, you know, lots of jewels. So it appeals to male and female. You see many of these bands, pop stars, who are very androgynous. The big hair, and you know, some of them even wear makeup, and you know, well, Boy George is gay. So that's a bit different. But yeah, okay, Boy George. But I'm thinking more of these glam rock kind of bands, you know.
But even George Harrison is gay.
Yeah. So there's always a very strong element of the feminine among the these men, you know. So Krishna was very much like this, you see. So the gopis, the milkmaids of Vrindavan. Who are they? He did this rasa dance, this very intimate dance by the light of the full moon. There were 108 gopis. 108. And one Krishna.
Gopis.
Right? But Krishna, because he's God, expanded himself into how many forms? 108. 108 forms. 107 more. And danced with each girl individually. So there was a ring of 108, you know, going around their circle. Not unlike a Celtic stone circle, where they would dance by the light of the harvest moon. And but in this case, Krishna expanded himself, so each gopi had Krishna to herself. That's what you want, because we all want God for ourselves. We don't want a queue. No queues. No one wants the queue. Either I'm at the head of the queue or I'm not in the queue. Right? That's what we ideally. So who are these souls?
Where they were.
They were young. See, a lot of people will tell you that this is, you know, very lustful and dark and sensuous and sexy and erotic, and it wasn't like that. It's more like infatuation, young girl and boy love. They weren't swinging from the branches doing stuff. It was more a pure-hearted, innocent love that you would have between, you know, between 12-year-olds, when they might touch hands, and might look at each other, and you know, bashful and coy and shy and steal a moment's glance, you know, just like you would do at that age, because no one's bold enough and no one has any experience to know what to do. So that beauty, that purity, that innocence was there. So anybody tells you it was different than that.
Like Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, exactly. So I was thinking about this and doing some reading, and then I came up with this little list that popped out of my head. So let's look. So I'm going to answer the question, who were the gopis, by explaining this to you. Here's the bottom level. Here's the top level in terms of relationship with God. The bottom level is an atheist. Atheist says there ain't no God. So the relationship with God is in effect non-existent. Right? That's the atheist. Now, maybe I got these in the wrong order. I'll have to rethink the next level up. This guy believes in God, but he hates God. Hate that God. He's envious of God. This one down here doesn't even believe he exists, but this one, he believes he exists, but if I would get my hands on him, I'd fix him. You know, what did we see on the telly the other day? The guy says, congratulations on your great success, your new book. The guy says, well, thank you very much. I just hate you. That sort of thing, you know. I did it sort of with a gay theme there because the guy was gay. But so envy. The next level up is the agnostic. The agnostic doesn't know whether there is God or there isn't God. I don't know. Some days I think there is. Some days I'm not sure. I don't have any real faith. I don't have a conviction. I don't have a strong belief. I don't have a resoluteness. Depends which way the wind is blowing. That's the agnostic.
But they firmly believe it can't be proved. Isn't that right? That's their belief.
No, not... most of the agnostics I've met kind of lean toward having it proved. They kind of like to believe it.
I think I'm an agnostic.
Atheist says that can't be proven. You can't prove it to me, no matter what. That's the atheist.
Yeah.
You know, prove to me with science. And you think you are an agnostic?
Well, I don't know if it's because there's a lot of me that believes in us, but I always question, what if?
It's good to question because questioning is a sign of intelligence, mm-hmm. discretion, discrimination. No one should follow anything blindly and swallow hook, line, and sinker without asking intelligent questions and, you know, to understand things at a greater depth. That's very important.
Most of me believes it.
But some of you doesn't.
Some of me thinks, well, if it's the scientific theory of we all just die and nothing happens.
Yeah.
I'm just like, well, so be it. It's more fun pretending that all of this exists, you know? If that was the way it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that makes me agnostic.
Well, but it sounds like it makes you agnostic.
Yeah.
Sounds like that. Okay, so atheist, hates God, agnostic, next level, fears God. This one believes in God, but is afraid of God, or believes in God because they're afraid. Because I'm going to get smited. This is very popular in the States, especially in the South, what they call the Bible Belt. And it is the land of hellfire and brimstone. And I'll put the fear of God in you, you know, like this. Fearing God's never really appealed to me, you know, doesn't never really made sense. But you can control lots of people with fear. If you don't do this, you are going to hell.
How does that person above an agnostic?
Because this person actually believes in God. We're talking about relationship with God. Agnostic doesn't have a relationship with God because they don't necessarily believe in God. Mm-hmm. You know, we might rethink this and say, wait a second. The one who hates God is higher than the agnostic because the one who hates God believes there's God. Mm-hmm. The agnostic doesn't, so I might have to change the category around. But anyway, you know, these are kind of loose. Okay, so fears God. Believes in God, but is more afraid of what's going to happen to me if I don't toe the line. If I do this, this, and this, am I going to suffer by bad karma? What goes around comes around. We all believe that. I've never met anybody who doesn't believe that. Or worse yet, that when I die, I'm going to go to hell. Or I'm going to suffer. Or I'm going to suffer from my sins in some way. Yeah, but when I die, I go to hell for a time. Worse yet is though many religions teach that hell is eternal. You burn in the eternal damnation of hell. That's a long time.
But there's great pride in that. There's huge pride in fearing God, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am without a doubt a God-fearing man.
Yeah.
This kind of nonsense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So fears God. Next one up. Now we're getting up to the positive stratosphere here. Takes a while to get there, though, doesn't it? You know? Now, reveres God. Reveres God. Awe and reverence. It's explained in the Vedas. This is this rasa. Rasa means taste or flavor. But rasa more in an expanded form means relationship, the kind of rasa you have with somebody. One of your friends, whenever you're together, you make jokes and you make each other laugh. That's your rasa, to make each other laugh. Another friend, you go and you play tennis together. You don't do anything else with this person. You only play tennis. Your rasa is tennis. See, different. You'll have different friends for different reasons. Or you go play music with somebody or somebody. That's the music rasa. So whatever it might be. So this rasa is called shanta rasa in Sanskrit. So it's the rasa of awe and reverence to God. This is God is high and mighty and powerful, all-powerful, omniscient, omnipotent. Fall down. You know, that's, you never approach God. You can't approach, you can't look at him. You know. Right? Now, when you merge into Brahman, Brahman means spirit, pure spirit, and you lose your identity, and you as a soul merge into that energy of all those souls, and you become one with, you merge, that is one example of shanta rasa. Another example of Shantarasa is Paramatma realization, soul and super soul, which is what you get from practicing Patanjali on a higher level, is Paramatma.
The question is it boring for them?
It says in the Vedas, it actually says in the Bhagavad Gita, that those who merge into Brahman, into pure spirit, after time, there's not much to do. So you do experience eternality, sat. You do experience full knowledge or consciousness, chit. And you do experience bliss or ananda. But there ain't nothing going on. There's no activity. So many times those souls will come back down because there's more going on, usually in the name of doing welfare work. And this is very popular with the lamas. You know, Buddhist lamas come down and keep helping out, you know. So it is said that it's a hard level to maintain because there's not much going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's humans, no, I don't want to say humans. Souls on some level prefer variety and stimulus. Because variety and stimulus is in the Godhead. It's not just the energy. Mm. You know, we want...
I thought when you were in my house that you're...
You would have no material wants connected to the body. But you're talking about a level of desirelessness, but there's also there's material desirelessness, but you could have spiritual desires. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's true what you're saying, but that's only one way to look at it. Okay, so I'm continuing. Mm-hmm. So, shanta, revering God. Next one up, serving God. So we're not so struck that we're paralyzed and can't move as we are in reverence. But now we want to actually do something. We want to interact. What do you need? What can I get for you? It's like a cup of tea. What do you need? What can you give me a job I can do? So now you're in a relationship. This is a dynamic relationship. In this case, God and servant, master and servant, but in the best sense. And that is called dasya rasa, service. And it takes place in the Vaikuntha planets, which is where Vishnu and Lakshmi reside. So Vishnu and Lakshmi, as I've told you in the past, it's very formal. If you go to their court or where it is they reside on their palace, their place, it's all very beautiful and formal. And you would be introduced like you would the king. And you'd go in and you'd have a protocol and maybe you'd bow and, you know, you'd be on your best behavior. You'd be minding your P's and Q's. And then, you know, you wouldn't come up and slap him on the back and say, "Hey Vishnu, what's up?" You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't say storyboard. No, you wouldn't say that. So that is the level at which that takes place. Now, the topmost level, beyond revering God, beyond serving God, is love. No, love. We did the oneness below. Yeah, revering we did. Is loving God. Loving God. And there, according to the Vedas, are three categories. We've talked about this before. In which you can engage in relationship with God in love. They are Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. Sakya means friendship. Comes from the root word sakha, which means branch. If you're the tree, who are your branches? Your posse, your friends, your mates, your pals. Those are your branches. So from that we get sakya, friendship. So you can have, and friendship means equals. Now, it's not to be understood you're on the same level as God, but you're on the same level of familiarity and intimacy, like you would with your friends. And you crack jokes, and you take the piss, and you go off and you do things together, you know, play some sport, watch a game, I don't know, ride horses, whatever it is you do, off you go. That's that level. Then, one above that is Vatsalya, parental relationship. You become the parent to God. When Krishna took birth on earth, he had not two parents, he had four. He had two natural parents, Vasudeva and Devaki. Then he was switched at birth so that Kamsa didn't kill him. And he was taken to his foster home across the Yamuna River into Rajabhumi, into the agrarian society, and there Yashoda and Nanda were his parents, foster parents. Right? So there's four souls who acted as parents for that.
But they're still serving him.
They're serving him. But the difference is they're not friends. The parent is in charge and they're telling him what to do. "You little monkey, get over here right now. Let me clean up your face. Or you're going to get one or two." And that's God you're talking to. Well, I mean, if you look at the Christian example, and you've got, if you want to take Jesus Christ, well, you got Mary and Joseph telling him what to do, for example. So you can participate on that level. So not only is it intimate, but you're the person in charge over God. And why does he listen to you? Out of? Out of love. Out of love. Because he knows that you have his welfare at heart. Children respect parents who lay the law down, not parents who let them do whatever they damn well please. They like to make you think that they like that, but they don't. Topmost is madhurya rasa, conjugal love, intimacy with God, sexual loving intimacy with God. Can you even bring your mind to it? That's the gopis. That's who the gopis are. So they could have that intimate boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, how sexual it was. I said at 12 years old it wouldn't have been, but Krishna then, as he grew up and became a man, he married 1,008. It was 1,008, I think. 1,008 wives he had. No, that's with Vishnu. 1,008 wives that Krishna married were all expansions of Lakshmi. Correct. Goddess of fortune. But they were all different persons. And he had 1,008 palaces.
You wouldn't want to be on a road to wait for 1,000 wives to go back.
He manifested himself in each palace. So he was with each wife. I mean, multiple wives in many historical examples in certain societies were accepted. And, if a woman is happy to be married to a man who has more than one wife and everybody's being looked after, so be it. There are also examples of the other way around. Even with the Pandavas, Draupadi was married to the 5 Pandava brothers. They had one wife. And they all, each one of them, their father was one of the gods. And the mother was Kunti. They shared the same mother. So it has worked both ways. But that's a good example. The highest level is intimate relations. And that is possible. The gopis were sages in previous lifetimes, yogis, mystics, whose sole focus was this high, high level of rasa, or exchange with the Godhead. So they didn't want to be just yogis, they wanted to be intimately involved with the Godhead and qualified themselves. So in that lifetime, they 5,000 years ago, they were called. It was their turn. And they became the milkmaidens of Vrindavan and enjoyed these intimate, loving exchanges with God himself. So those are all the levels of relationship, having given this much thought, unless you can think of one that I missed, but I think they're all there. So all you do is decide what level you might want to operate at. And if you essentially, it comes down to two different philosophical beliefs ice.
Is that one you believe?
Ice, yeah. You either believe that I'm God, you're God, we're all God, and therefore we're all equal, and we're going to merge into the oneness and return to being God at some point. And that's one belief. The other belief is that God could never become covered over by illusion, as we are covered over by illusion, forgetting our true identity and who we are. So therefore, we're not God by definition. And we will never be equal to God. The most we can do is go into one of these relationships with God. That's the other belief. Obviously, if you sat here long enough, you know that that's the one that I believe in and that I adhere to. Because I don't believe that God could be covered over by definition. So you can believe whichever one you like, as far as I'm concerned.
Do you believe that eventually you will become God again, don't you?
No.
Even after the matter?
No, I don't believe I'll become God. I believe I'll become God-like and godly.
Yeah, or a part of.
Yeah, well, we're all part of it anyway, but my consciousness will become God conscious. And what I want is I want to have a relationship with God. I want to hang out with Him. The relationship I gravitate to is friendship. That's the one that feels right to me, for me. And that's what I aspire to, hanging out with Him, pushing Him over and wrestling and
18 holes?
No, 18 holes doesn't appeal to me. Chasing the cows, riding horses, that appeals to me.
We're in training here.
Drinking,
yeah. So, this is the night of the Rasa Dance. So it's a wonderful night for meditation. Now, we talked a little bit about that. We better talk a little bit about Lakshmi, because it's Lakshmi's day as well. So I said this is one of the most auspicious days. Now, I was doing a little reading here from this book, Devi, the Goddess. And some of the stories that I'm familiar with are presented a bit differently here. I don't know if this is a South Indian approach. I think it is, because what I know is some of these similar tales, but this is a different context, and I think some of it's South Indian approach. South India, North India, that's kind of how it's divided. It's understood that the greater remnant of Vedic culture exists in South India, because South India was less invaded and less influenced by Muslims, Portuguese, Franciscans, and all the rest that came in over the years. It was mostly in the north, although some of them did reach the south. So, Lakshmi. Let's talk about her. Lakshmi is the goddess of affluence and abundance. She represents the beautiful and bountiful aspect of nature, first as Bhu Devi. What does Bhu, B-H-U? Earth. As Bhu Devi, the earth goddess, she nurtures life. As Shri Devi, the goddess of fortune, she bestows power, pleasure, and prosperity on those who deserve her grace. So here, Lakshmi is divided into two aspects: goddess of the earth, goddess of fortune. It's different. To realize her, one must respect the laws of life, the earth, and appreciate the wonders of existence. This is her sacred narrative. So now we get to some of the creation myths. In the beginning, there was water everywhere. Now, when they say beginning, it could be the beginning of a certain millennium. It could be in between the four yugas, Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, when there is a temporary dissolution. Or it could be the nighttime of Brahma. Or it could be the Maha dissolution, where the whole thing is wrapped up for a long time. It's a creation, just like we have night and day. During night, everything's wrapped up. It's as if nothing's going on. People are at home, they're in bed, not much takes place. And then it's recreated the next morning when the sun comes up. Same thing happens on a big scale, on the macrocosmic scale, with the creation. It's not like this is going on all the time. There's a time when it's absorbed back into the body of Vishnu, or however you want to say it. And this goes into a state of dormancy. Are we not heading toward that now? Are the leaves not falling off the trees? So even within the seasons, because it's how everything works. That is the constant cycle. Okay. So in the beginning, there was water everywhere. There was nothing to eat, nowhere to live. The divine patriarch saw the plight of his children and invoked Devi, the goddess. The goddess whispered into his ear, "The earth lies beneath the waters, and she must be raised up." So then there's the story of Vishnu taking the form of the boar incarnation. Well, why would he take the form of a boar? Because who better to go at the bottom of the water and scoop up? Because that's what boars do. They scoop up things that are, you know, the dregs. So the boar went, brought the earth up on the tusks, and rescued her. And that's Varaha, incarnation of Vishnu. So he plunged into the sea, found the earth goddess Bhu Devi on the ocean floor, placing her on his snout. He gently raised her to the surface. Then he turned into the giant turtle, Matsya. Kurma is the turtle, and offered Bhu Devi a seat on his back. Well, I hadn't heard that before. It's a little different. Okay, then, seated on the celestial turtle, the earth goddess nurtured life in her bountiful arms. She offered food and shelter to all. That's the earth's duty. The devas or gods admired her beauty. The asuras or demons craved her wealth. This is it right here. There's the whole story right there. The devas or gods admired the beauty of the earth, and therefore their greatest motivation was to do what? To preserve that beauty, to be stewards of the earth. But the asuras or materialists craved her wealth, meaning sucker energy. Take whatever you can, as much as you can, as fast as you can, and never mind what happens. Never mind the result. Drill here, drill now. And what? What's the third one? Drill here, drill now, and drill with lots. Mm-hmm. All right? We've talked about drilling. Oil in the earth is her, according to the Vedas, her lifeblood. It's lifeblood. So we're draining the lifeblood. And guess what? It's catching up with us. So, yeah. So the devas, the gods and the demons fought many a battle over the earth. Finally, under the leadership of the powerful demon Bali, the asuras emerged triumphant. They beat the gods. Impressed by Bali's strength, the goddess came to him as Shri and crowned him king of the earth. She offered him a throne, a footstool, and held an umbrella over his head. One of the symbols for kingship, according to the Vedic tradition, is a white umbrella. Because the king has the umbrella, because he puts everybody under his umbrella. Ella, Ella.
Hey.
Hey, hey. Sorry, I slipped into that thing. Sri Devi's sacred white elephant turned into clouds and sprinkled life-bestowing rain upon the earth, watering fields and pastures so that crops grew abundantly and cows gave plenty of milk. Everyone was happy with Bali as their king. So even though he was a demon, he was actually an enlightened soul and knew that the earth should be protected and treated well. He knew that. But what happened? He had achieved a position of power, and power caused him to become arrogant. What happened to the ego? Inflated. You know what happens when the ego gets inflated, don't you? And he thought, no, pardon me, he declared, the earth belongs to me. I can give anyone anything they desire. These words annoyed the earth goddess. Didn't like to hear that. Inflated ego. That's what's happening with the stock market, banks. This is inflated ego. Yeah, this is... What do you mean, don't bring it in here? This is exactly where to bring it. So, these words annoyed the earth goddess. She belonged to nobody and certainly was not a commodity to be given away as a gift. She didn't like that. I suppose she's not real keen on being raped either of her various resources. Then Indra, the king of the gods, who was no longer king because he had been bereft of Shri's grace, he had been reduced to poverty. He approached Bali and he begged for a little bit of land. And, this is a little bit different story. Bali pointed to Vishnu. Vishnu was in his dwarf form of Vaman. He was a dwarf. He wasn't a misshapen dwarf. He was a beautiful, beautiful boy. He looked like a boy, but he was a dwarf. So Bali said, I'll give you as much land as this one can cover with three steps. Not really realizing that this was Vishnu as a dwarf. This is a different one. As soon as Bali said this, then what happened was he said, okay, take three steps and go ahead, I'll give you that land. So immediately, Vishnu expanded himself. Like this. With the first step, he covered all the lower worlds of the universe, down to the bottom. With the second step, he covered up to the top. So now, in two steps, he covered the entire universe. He said, what am I to do with my third step? You told me I got to have three. And Bali's ego deflated and said, Lord, please, place your third step on my head. So he became an enlightened being. His ego was deflated and balance was restored. So Vishnu thus wrested control back to the gods. So the gods may lack strength, but they are intelligent. I shall go to them, said Shri, the goddess of fortune. She turned away from Bali and the demons and went to the gods. She blessed the gods with ruling majesty, material prosperity, physical health, bodily beauty, and divine fortune. Angry and bitter in their defeat, the demons rasped, Shri Devi is nothing but Chanchala. The fickle one, Chanchala means fickle. So what do we know about wealth? It comes and it goes. It doesn't spend much time with any human. You may have it for lifetimes. You may have it all this lifetime. You may have it for several lifetimes, but you won't always have it. And the only one that Lakshmi or Shri stays with permanently is Vishnu, God. And anyway, the demons accused her of being Chanchala, the fickle one. Once she favored Bali, now she favors Indra and the gods. She's faithful to no one. And she said, that's not true. I'm eternally faithful to the person who does not abuse my gifts. Well, she's becoming, guess what's happening in the world right now? She's going away. That's what's happening. Do you think there was any abuse of gifts? Was there any greed? So they asked Vishnu, well, seeing how you brought this about, don't you want to become king of the gods and control everything? And Vishnu said, no, I don't really desire anything. And by defeating the demon Bali, I've done my duty. I don't need to be rewarded for it. Lakshmi went, oh, that's what I like to do. Isn't that attractive? A man that doesn't need to get pumped up and told how wonderful he is. So she begins to fall for Vishnu. These words of Vishnu pleased Shri Devi. Okay, so it goes on and on and on, but those are it's part of the story.
So very briefly, astrologically, where is all this money, global warming happening?
Oh, you can read about it. It's on my website.
Yeah, I need to get your website. I don't have it.
Are you not on our mailing list?
I think you've got my old email address. Hmm.
Yeah, we did an article a couple of weeks ago called 2009, The Gathering Clouds. That's on there. Yeah, you can read that, but that's a prediction for 2009. And
what's going to happen with the U.S. election? What's the prediction?
Well, that's on there too. Yeah, U.S. presidential election. What I said was, it looks like Obama. I analyzed the charts of McCain and Obama. And I think it's going to be Obama. And obviously he's ahead. And what I said was I reserved my final prediction for a week before the election. But based on their charts, I think it'll be him. But you should read both articles. One is under articles and says USA presidential election. The other one is under planetary events. And it says 2009, the gathering clouds. Because you read them together and they make more sense. So we'll see how it plays out. Okay. Let's do the RT. Well, why don't we do a meditation first and then we'll do the RT. Close your eyes. Breathe. Relax. And let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax. breathe and let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant light coming down, down from the heavens all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, your torso, your arms, your legs, out the bottom of your feet, into the earth below. Relax. See and feel yourself by means of the pearl white light, connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Relax and breathe. All right. You're in the higher realms. It is beautiful. Unlike anything you've ever seen before, you've never been to such a place. This is where God resides. Here he comes now. In what form or in what energetic form does he appear in front of you now? What do you see? What do you sense? What do you feel? Depending on your perception, he offers a relationship between you and he. What kind of relationship is offered? Is it what you want? What does it feel like to you? Are you willing? Are you happy about this? Do you agree? If so, if you agree to go into relationship with God, when will you be prepared to begin? Will you put it off for some time? Tell him you're too busy right now. Will you do it shortly? Or will you do it immediately? What is your reply to the offer of relationship? How does he respond to your reply? Continue until you are complete and it has reached a point of resolution. When you're finished, return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. Which shouldn't be hard since you just met God. Okay. All right. Very good. Yeah. We'll have our tea.